This is the Shogun Podcast on TV Podcast Industries. We're on to the penultimate episode of Shogun, Chapter 9, Crimson Sky.
I do not think the heretic is here on Torunaga's behalf. When I was in Edo, he had been cut loose. Torunaga has given up.
Or you are blind to their trickery.
This felt different. His most loyal vassal killed himself right in front of him. If John Blackthorne is here, it is only because he is trying to find his own way out.
Tempest in a bottle. War is coming.
Welcome back, fellow warriors, to TV Podcast Industries. We're talking about Shogun Chapter 9, the penultimate episode, Crimson Sky. I'm one of your hosts, Derek.
Hello there, fellow warriors. I am your other host, John. Welcome to this episode of the podcast. Well, I'm exhausted. Yes, it took me a while to get over this episode with the tension and the huge emotional tension in it.
Absolutely.
So good. How they keep that tension as taut as a violin string.
I was absolutely on tenterhooks the whole way through the episode, just wondering what was going to happen next. Very difficult episode to watch, but really, really good.
I mean, given, you know, no massive battle peak here, it almost feels like understated in what you expect to happen.
Without a doubt.
With these two closing episodes, it would kind of be building to some kind of physical action piece or, you know, this warfare, effectively.
Yeah.
But instead, it's this really intimate warfare and tension.
Yeah.
Really kind of high political game playing going on here, but so dramatically tense. And of course, with absolute personal consequences, as we find out. So, so good. This show just continues to amaze me.
Yeah, absolutely. I do really wonder, people who haven't read the book and didn't know how the story was going to go, like ourselves, I wonder how it's going to play with them. It's interesting. I've seen lots of comments as the episodes have been going on. People have become really big fans of the show, but I think earlier on there were a lot of comments in the first couple episodes kind of going, well, there's a lot of talking here, not much fighting. I'm expecting army versus army battles going on, and that's kind of been avoided quite a lot in the show.
Yeah, it's actually about the political maneuvering to get into positions of power.
Exactly.
And any kind of battle is, in a sense, it's been shown in flashback.
Yeah.
I mean, whether we get a battle in the final episode, that's possibly still to come. We just don't know. But certainly, it's all hinted at, but it's also the political warfare, really, here.
Yeah, but I do think that's the point of the series of Shogun, is Torunaga no longer wants warfare. That was the purpose of having the Taiko beforehand. If he's to take over, he no longer wants battles and warfare in Japan. I think there's some kind of stat that so many battles were happening up until 1600 that everybody had lost somebody that was related to them.
Yeah.
So Torunaga's trying to avoid a battle at all costs. I'm just interested to see, and I'm sure our wonderful fellow warriors will be sending in the feedback in this episode, and I'm interested to see how it's landing with them that the show's avoiding those big battles.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I think the historical context, you know, not to oversimplify it, is that the different clans, the majority of people in Japan are weary of war.
Exactly.
There has been far too much bloodshed over the previous centuries, and it's began to get weary, and it's trying to maneuver without large-scale conflict.
Exactly.
I think is really what's kind of been shown here.
But as you say, with lots of conflict, just not large-scale army versus army conflict.
Lots of personal conflicts, lots of personal machinations, maneuvering, and trickery, and it's all in the service of gaining power, which is also what warfare is about.
Exactly.
It's just in a different way.
Exactly.
So really, really good
Yeah, it is. It's really, really good. Just as we're coming up to the last episodes of Shogun, we'd love if you came over and subscribed to the podcast on any podcast provider, wherever you get your podcast. The main podcast feed is TV Podcast Industries, so go find that. Or you can pop it over to our website at tvpodcastindustries.com. There's loads of options for you there to subscribe to our main feed with all the other shows that we cover on a regular basis. We've been podcasting for 10 years. The Shogun podcast was our 10th anniversary podcast, something a bit different for us, but hopefully you'll find something else that you're interested in over there. We do, of course, still want to hear your thoughts about Shogun. Email us to feedback@tvpodcastindustries.com and we'll chat about them on the next episode.
Yes, but let us get into our spoiler-filled discussion of Chapter 9 of Shogun, mm-hmm. Crimson Sky. Derek, what are some of the episode details?
The show, of course, is based on the James Clavell 1975 novel of the same name. The head writers for the show are Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks. This episode was written by Rachel Kondo and Kayleen Puente. Kayleen is a story editor in Shogun and was an assistant to Justin Marks on his previous show, Counterpart.
Okay, excellent.
Yeah, that's quite cool. So they must have worked together. Rachel Kondo and Justin Marks are married, so they must have worked together and known Kayleen from that work on Counterpart.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's quite cool. Yeah. And this episode was directed by Frederick Toy. This is his third episode of Shogun, and he directs next week's finale. He also directed Fallout, which came out this week. I think it was three episodes of Fallout as well. It was just interesting seeing his name pop up on each of the episodes. We binged the entire season of Fallout since it came
out. Absolutely.
We aren't
so much better than the video game.
It is significantly
at
better.
At least for me.
Yeah. I think we both had tried to play some of the video games and gotten through about an hour maybe. And
No. Yeah. I spent 3 hours and I hadn't gotten out of the vault and I was like, okay, screw this. Because as I came out of the vault, it was like this open world where I could like squash a bug or whatever. Uh-huh. I didn't know which direction to go to and I had no idea where I was supposed to go, to be honest. So I kind of just gave it a miss, but it's in the wheelhouse of BioShock, which is one of my mm-hmm. favorite games in terms of that kind of almost, steampunk type of or 60s sci-fi, you know, those kind of crosses and amalgamations.
Yeah,
so I really like that style and I really enjoyed the series of Fallout. And of course, I really like Jonathan Nolan as well in
Absolutely.
Terms of, you know, the stuff he's done.
Yeah.
Person of Interest, but also Westworld, mm-hmm. his big stuff. So, really good.
Yeah, it was really good. We're obviously, as you could probably tell, we're not going to cover it on the podcast. The entire season of Fallout was dropped in one day on Prime Video, which is something that we tend not to cover unless it's something that we've covered before, like Umbrella Academy or Sandman or The Witcher. They've all been shows
Marvel
that we've covered
Netflix
in the past.
Back in the day.
Exactly.
But that's when everything was just dropped all at once.
But obviously, as we're covering so much of the stuff on our main feed on the podcast, we couldn't get around to covering Fallout. But go check it out if you're into the style, as John just described it there. It's definitely worth watching if you're into that kind of thing.
And it's got a really nice, dark sense of humor.
It really does. That was the thing that surprised me most.
Yeah, given it's all in the context of an atomic bomb drop.
Mm-hmm.
So, yes, nicely, darkly human.
Very much so, very much so. But let's get back to Shogun. John, do you want to tell us what they gave us with your synopsis for Shogun, Chapter 9, Crimson Sky?
Sure. Mariko arrives in Osaka for the fight of her life. Blackthorn and Yabushige scramble to save their own heads as their options dwindle.
Hmm.
Yes. This to me was just storyboarding from tension to more tension to more tension.
Exactly.
It was really sort of punctuated with superbly dramatically tense pieces.
Definitely.
And I thought it was fantastic. Yeah. In fact, I thought it was phenomenal. I just really, really enjoyed it. I was totally on edge for the whole of this episode,
and
which is an hour long.
Absolutely. And we've watched it three times now as well. So
I'm a shambling, nervous wreck.
Absolutely. But even multiple watches still don't take away the tension. Well, we start with Yabushige and Blackthorn in our Bushido 1. Because there is a massive amount of tension at the beginning. And I'm not too sure exactly how much John Blackthorn understands. Well, the main Bushido here is Yabushige offers John in exchange for his life. So he offers to Ishido the use of the engine in exchange for him keeping his head. So I just loved how the scene all played out. We see that John now understands a lot more about Japanese culture and is starting to understand the language a bit more. Although there is a conversation between John and Yabushige where Yabushige tries to explain his plan what he's going to do, sort of, tells John to stay by his side when they go and talk to Ishida the next day, and all John responds with is, "Tomorrow, Ishida." And I'm not sure whether John understands that he's going to be handed back over to Ishida.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really clear in this moment that John Blackthorne is effectively being used as a pawn.
Yes.
Of the ruling class in Japan.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it is to learn new tactics in order to give them the advantage on the battlefield, like we saw with the cannons.
Yep.
Whether it is as a distraction almost, which I almost feel Torunaga, as well as the strategy and tactics of cannon warfare and naval warfare, John Blackthorne is the talk of a lot of people, or he's dismissed as the barbarian, and yet, and Torunaga is in effect using that as a distraction almost, you know, because it draws the conversation, but at the same time he can hide behind that, or he can get something from it, whilst they think it's sort of almost, that John Blackthorne is a plaything of Torunaga. Yes, he is, but also Torunaga is using him strategically.
Yes.
Here, the Yabashige wants to use him as well in order to try and keep himself alive.
Exactly.
But there's also, you know, the conversation between him and Lord Kiyama as well, where, you know, Lord Kiyama feels like he will have John Blackthorne back where he can effectively be executed for being not Catholic, not Portuguese. And you have that really interesting conversation there from Kiyama, which is like, you know, I don't concern myself too much with matters of faith. It's
absolutely.
I'm a student of trade.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the trade element that is the important thing in this relationship of faith with the Catholic Church, but also with the Portuguese emissaries.
Yes, it is. But that's in response to John's accusation to him. He asks him, is it faith in God or your purse strings that are more important to you? And his response is that he's more of a student of trade. So kind of selling himself there as someone that isn't Christian, even though he says all the words and follows along with the Portuguese. And interesting, again, someone else speaking in English or Portuguese to John at that point. So he's talking to him in his own language. Other people can't hear around him. So I think he feels pretty comfortable in front of John saying that, actually, no, I'm about the commerce, not about the religion. So nobody else can understand that. So that was a really interesting moment. And it kind of feeds into something later on in the episode, I think. It kind of sets up that this character really doesn't care about the religious side of things as long as he's getting paid. So I thought
absolutely.
That was quite interesting.
Well, he's accumulated great wealth with this relationship, and by virtue of that, great power. I mean, there is that moment where he says, well, not all the guns in Japan should be owned by you.
So he is from a position
of strength because he has all these modern armaments, you know, cannons, muskets, pistols, and so on, you know?
Yeah, exactly. But interestingly, the offer from Yabashiga to Ishida is turned down. Ishida says to him that the heir has no interest in the barbarian, and that's the end of it, and they're just told to move aside and sit back. And you kind of see that moment from Yabashiga kind of going, well, we tried, I guess.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Like, I really love this whole sort of court meeting with Ishida and Achiba there. Mm-hmm. And the first part of this business was with Yabashige, who was effectively giving the formal, almost surrender, you know, I am surrendering on behalf of Torunaga here whilst he's still grieving for his son. I mean, which is met with a really harsh response. Well, he's got many more sons from Ishida. You know, there is this quite clear sort of view that there are tricks going on here, or there is maneuvering at least. But I love how Ishido's, he just describes all of Yabashige's pleasantries and proposals are as hollow words from a traitor.
Yes.
And he's dismissed. Like, as you say, Yabashige is saying, I tried. Whether this in and of itself is a smokescreen by Ishido, because we do hear later, you know, that Ishido has accepted Yabushige's offer of service. But
yeah,
you know,
I think that's only when he's been backed into a corner later on in the episode.
Agreed,
I think at this point he is no longer willing to tolerate Yabushige. He's turned on him multiple times. He's followed Toranaga's orders. Yabushige tries to play off that it was Toranaga's maneuvering that got him to free Toranaga from Asaka without Yabushige knowing that, but unfortunately, the battle that ensued afterwards that killed lots of Ishida's men was led by Yabushige. So,
yeah.
So he's not able to stand over that well enough for Ishida. So I think at this point, actually, early on in the episode, Yabushige was still very much in danger of dying until that later offer comes in.
No, absolutely. The other interesting point here with this sort of meeting of the court is we do learn that Ishido and Uchiba are engaged.
They did get engaged, yes. That's quite interesting, because last time we talked about in last week's episode that Ishiba wouldn't answer any questions from anybody. She is someone like Toranaga who makes her decisions in her own pace, and the offer of marriage was laid out by Ishido, and she did not answer at all. So this episode we hear from Mariko that the two are engaged.
Yeah. I think the other interesting thing here with John Blackthorne as well, you know, this kind of notion that he's a bit of a rag doll being passed between the ruling elite, even when he's requested to come for an audience with the heir, the boy king. Mariko points out it's only so that I could be brought in front of Uchiba, yes, so that we could have communication between ourselves without it attracting suspicion.
Yes.
You know, in the end, he's just in the background whilst this phenomenal discussion between the two sort of plays out.
Yeah, really. Absolutely.
But I think, I mean, that's not to say John doesn't have merit and value, as I've said. It's just that he's not, in a sense, that important. This is an internal matter.
Yes.
Whatever, once it's consolidated that they may want to play Portuguese off with Dutch and British or whatever. And, you know, at the moment, as it stands, you know, John is viewed as a barbarian, even though he's been able to learn some, some Japanese, a decent amount, as Uchiba kind of sort of recognizes.
Yeah. But although I do love that he says the phrase to her in Japanese, could you please speak slowly and use simple words to me? And she looks at him and goes, you've learnt that phrase. That's a smart thing to do. Mariko must have taught you. That's the phrase that you say when you enter a room for the first time. So similar to what I was saying last week about some of his major phrases seem to be things you could learn as sentences or from a phrase book almost.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's why I think that conversation that was there between Yabushige and John was quite funny, because both of them are looking at each other. They can kind of feel the intent around it, but I'm not too sure whether John was fully clear on what Yabushige's plan was, even though it was told to him, sort of, because Yabushige was trying to obscure a little bit his intent. But an interesting opener for the episode. The majority of the episode itself, as anybody who's watched it will be aware of, it is mostly about Mariko from here on.
Yeah,
she is
absolutely
a really central character in the episode. We'll move on to Bushido 2 in a second, but the episode does even open with Mariko 14 years ago trying to walk out into the snow and effectively take her own life by dying in the snow. And that's when she's pregnant with her child as well. So we have known throughout the series that she's always felt the need to commit seppuku in response to what her father had done, that she always was going to take her own life but was not allowed to by Buntaro. So this is a third attempt at taking her own life in the flashback that we see.
Yeah, no, it's interesting, actually, because we also do see her kind of first connection with Father Martin as he kind of introduces her to, I guess, his own faith by giving her a cross with rosary beads.
Yes.
As always, you know, starting her on the path of Christianity. Mm-hmm. But the really interesting thing that Father Martin said to her is, I also, too, have felt loss and been through hardship, and I believe God spurred me for a purpose.
Yeah.
And I think with Mariko's face is that actually, you know, we had that point of, you know, are you for the church or are you for your clan? And she says, I can be both.
Yes.
And I think that idea is that her faith, as well as her loyalty to the Toranaga clan, both drive her purpose
yes.
here, as well as, you know, the instructions that Toranaga has done, ultimately to get to the end that she is looking for,
yeah.
really, here.
Yeah.
So, you know, because there's a lot about her saying, you know, there is purpose in death as there is in life. There's a lot of philosophical discussions around
Absolutely.
Sort of death and dying.
Yeah.
But I thought that was an interesting line from Father Martin mm. here. It felt to me as though both her faith and, you know, her own Japanese culture
yeah.
and those loyalties to the clan have both driven her purpose here.
Absolutely.
In the end.
And I would think that that's quite a central tenet of Christian faiths. And I know certainly in my own upbringing in Catholicism that there's a tendency for people to encourage joining a Christian faith so that you have God there at all times to support you when nobody else is around. When you feel you're alone, God is there to support you. And that feels like what is being offered here by Father Martin, this idea that there's this one God that will always be there, will always hear you, and you're never alone on your own with your own thoughts. So obviously Mariko had lived her life very much alone and very much the last member of their clan left behind.
But it's interesting, yeah. isn't it? It's that moment of, you know, is Father Martin there in her moment of most need, which she most certainly is,
yes.
but also in her moment of most susceptibility.
Well,
to,
yeah.
I'm just, yeah. you know, I think it's very difficult to sort of separate
yes.
some of those things
yeah.
Sometimes.
I think Father Martin does believe he's doing the right thing. He is a true believer
agreed,
in God. I think of the characters that we see within the Portuguese that are here, it feels like Father Martin is the most godly or the most true Catholic that is here.
Yeah.
Because he seems to have more of a faith in God than the others. The rest of them all do seem to be quite taken with their purse strings and quite taken with the ruling orders in their countries, whereas Father Martin does tend to go much more on the religious side. So I think he is a true ally to Mariko
yeah,
and
definitely.
A true ally in the faith as well. So anyway, just thought it was an interesting opener to have the two of them. Let's get into our Bushido number two. Mariko's offer. Or what Mariko is here to do. So she is here in Osaka to take back Toranaga's wife and child. And she makes this statement, really, in front of Ushido, directly after Yabushiga had made his offer. I say that it is a statement. It's not an offer. She's not here to plead for the return of Toranaga's newly born son and his wife. She is here to tell them that is her role. She has been given the direction by Toranaga. She must accomplish this. That's her lord that's given her the direction. That's what you must do. Go there, pick them up, bring them back immediately, and then they will return to Osaka at the time appointed by Ushido once the period of mourning has passed for Toranaga's son and Toranaga. Yeah.
Well, that's it. I mean, again, this is one of the big first tense meetings, and it follows on immediately from Yabushige, and that's, you have that contrast here in this council meeting, because like Yabushige, Mariko goes through the pleasantries. There's a little reconnection with Lady Achiba as well around the poetry competition with the death of the Taiko's wife in the previous episode, and how, you know, Mariko was always good at those. They always had these poetry competitions. So you start the first line of the poem. You know, Mariko is all sort of falling into these pleasantries in a sense, but then she says, well, I'm not staying, so I won't be able to be involved in this competition.
Yeah.
And she'll be leaving with Lady Shizu and Kiri back to Toranaga whilst he's grieving. And it's this moment where actually the authority openly in this council meeting really is of Ushido. That authority is challenged by her. You know, I'll return unless you confine me here. You know, I will never be confined, held hostage or captive. And she says to Ushido, who keeps, you know, they're effectively butting heads here. He says, but she's refuses, I am no peasant to be trodden on. So she's asserting her authority over Ushido. I think if I remember correctly, the character of Ishido in history comes from a peasant upbringing, has worked his way up. So that, you know, she's stating, I come from a family of 1,000 years of samurai.
Yes.
So she's really challenging Ishido here, and it mm-hmm. makes for a really tense council meeting. You know, ultimately, her saying, I am free to go as I please.
Yep.
I am highborn lady in Clan Toranaga, effectively. Yep. He has given me an order, and I must carry out that as part of my duty, which mm-hmm. is to return Lady Shizu and Kiri back to him. And, I mean, you can see the kind of, you know, earlier on in this series, we saw Ishido just doing stamps on dockets mm-hmm. and realizing, well, he's a bureaucrat. Toranaga is something different. He does that as well,
yep.
but he's almost something different.
Yeah.
And here, Ishido really almost comes out with the bureaucratic, well, you will have to come back here in a few days anyway, so what's the point of going?
Just wait here.
Why don't you just wait here?
Yeah.
You know, no one's being held hostage here yet. Mm. Ultimately, the gates are locked. So I love this openly hostile, effectively challenge
Absolutely.
To Ishido through words by Mariko, really asserting and the determination that effectively, you know, in the morning she will be leaving with the two ladies back to Toranaga.
Yeah. And I suppose it's what makes it such an interesting show, because technically, again, it's a council of regents where Ishido has assumed a position higher than he actually has attained. He is not the leader. He is not the Taiko. He is not the new shogun. He is not the leader of Japan. But nobody's standing in his way when he's making directions. And the directions he's making sound, as you say, bureaucratically correct. They sound like they are just natural things to say. What's the point of leaving and coming back in 5 days' time? Stay Absolutely. Here now. Absolutely. And Mariko, knowing what he's trying to do here, trying to capture her as another prisoner amongst all of the prisoners of all of the families here, knows that technically he can't do this. If people find out that he's holding prisoners in the castle, there will be open revolt, and that's what she's trying to push. That's the real mission
from
Toranaga.
Exactly. And I mean, you know, it's a manufactured setup to mm-hmm. generate that situation, isn't
exactly.
it? And I think John Blackthorne describes it best. You know, you will walk into a sword to prove the blade is sharp.
Mm-hmm.
You know you can't leave, but you press it anyway.
Yeah.
And Yabushige, equally, you know, whereas he folds and Mariko continue to challenge Ishido, you know, Yabushige does kind of chastise her, you know, I know. And if I know, Ishido knows that this is Toranaga, and you know exactly what you were doing.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but it's setting the trap
exactly.
for Ishido, and he's fallen into it, this manufactured setup, effectively.
Exactly.
And it's just really, really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's just fascinating. And I love the power of Mariko in this scene here.
Absolutely.
She is not willing to give one inch, and that moment where she says, I am no peasant to be trotted on. You know, I just think that is so powerful. And as he's telling her this conversation is over, and she goes, this conversation is not over. You know, this is not, you're not able to stamp what you want on me. I am here at Toranaga's request, and I will leave exactly as I've been instructed by my lord. Fantastic. Yeah, really, really,
really good.
Will we go on to Bushido number 3, the culmination of this, which is Mariko trying to leave Osaka?
Yes. Absolutely. Bushido 3, Mariko tries to leave Osaka with no permit. And again,
well, a newly installed rule from Ishido
exactly.
after their meeting the previous day. Yeah.
And, you know, it's just, again, it's just another layer of tension, which I just thought was great. You see the perseverance, the determination of Mariko, but equally, as this whole scene sort of between the two gates, you know, it's the classic castle design where with the arches on top, where you see Mariko breaking down, whether that again is part of this act, you know, to sell it as well as being part genuine, you know, it does both effectively. But you see the frustration where she is fighting back tears, you know, we must go back. We are hostages, you know. and then informing everyone who's effectively watching from the battlements.
Yes.
I mean, there's Lord Kiyama, there's Ono, there's Yabushige, there's John Blackthorne, there's even Lady Achiba. They're watching this face-off effectively.
Yeah. Because in fairness, none of them had the bravery to do this at all. We heard them, the other leaders, when Ochiba came in and took over and has been working with Ishido, we heard them all go, "We're now her prisoners."
Yeah.
And none of them tried to leave.
Only one regent tried to leave, and he was killed.
Yeah. And now the conversation, as they arrived originally in Osaka, Blackthorne was told that there are members of every highborn house in all of Japan. There are members of them in the walls of Osaka, so nobody will attack Osaka, and they're being kept prisoners. So this is a moment where they're all watching on at Mariko, a young woman challenging the rule of Ishido, who shouldn't be ruler, but challenging the rule of Ishido. And even before that, even before she makes her move to leave, her son has been sent to her to plead with her to say, "You need to join up with the other Christian household. I've been betrothed to the granddaughter of Kiyama, so we can make a strong Christian household within Osaka. And if you try to leave, I'll disown you." And she still goes ahead and goes ahead with her plan. But I do think that moment where she doesn't fight through the guards that are there, I do think that she breaks at that moment. She has got the security of Taranaga's armed guard as she's leaving, and they are all cut down, leaving only a few members of Ishido's private army. And then more reinforcements are brought in, and she still takes her Nagakata, her weapon, to try and battle against them. But that moment where they're almost honorably playing with her, it's not like they're not respecting her fighting ability, but they're trying to make sure that she doesn't have any ability to actually battle against them. They're stopping her weapon from getting near them in a way that she's...
Yeah, I mean, I think she
feels totally overwhelmed.
I think she takes one of them down.
Maybe
another. But ultimately, she's being held by the numbers. It's her against effectively at least 10 or 12 soldiers here.
Yeah, exactly.
As well as with archers on the battlements.
Yeah.
You know, trying to sort of scare her from going any further forward.
Yeah. But I feel like she breaks down because she realizes at that moment the final part of Toranaga's plan must play out, which is because of the dishonor to her lord, she must take her own life.
And it is a public expression of what she verbalized in court. You know, it's on display, it's real to all those lords that are watching from the battlements that, yes, Lady Mariko is not free to leave. She is captive. She is confined.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's that public reality of that as well.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, that's the strong element here, which I think, you know, as we get into Bushido number 4, which is Mariko must take her own life. Before sunset, we have a number of different things playing out here where, you know, the regents are sat discussing this, you know, believing it to be a bluff. And Toranaga's half-brother is like, "This all seems over the top for, you know, really." But it is Lady Ishiba that says, you know, "You are all very wrong. It's her vengeance for the death of her father, and we will all be shamed if for allowing her to die, and there will be a revolt from every high family in Osaka if that happens, or we let her leave and the other hostages then will want to leave."
Yeah.
So, you know, this is the catch-22 now that has been handed to Ishido, and that he's put himself in there, you know?
Absolutely. And that's something I just loved about the scene.
Yeah.
Like, we've mentioned that the puppeteer behind everything has been Ishiba since she arrived, and she effectively allied herself with Ishido, and he then asks her for counsel, and her counsel is, "I have none. We are backed into a corner here, or you are backed into a corner here. I can walk away from this, basically. You're backed into a corner here. You've put us in a situation where either she dies and they revolt, or she leaves and everybody else leaves. So then thanks very much and I'll walk away from it. But she does take that opportunity, as you mentioned earlier on. She takes an opportunity to go and meet up with John Blackthorn under the guise of the heir wants to meet up with John, and meets up with Mariko to actually have that discussion between the two of them, which is loaded with direction from Ushiba to stop playing the games that she's playing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think this is really such an awesome piece of kind of drama. Mm-hmm. You know, Lady Ushiba, very much, you know, the games must stop. You can't bring nobility to Toranaga's warmongering, which is, you know, what she sees it as. But there is this realization that, you know, they were friends, and then Mariko was sent away and she lost her. That still resonates with Lady Ushiba.
Yeah.
But it comes kind of full circle with Mariko saying, you know, only you can end the games you accuse me of.
Mm-hmm.
In that she's part of the game playing by setting Ushido up against Toranaga, effectively getting engaged to him, as we found out at the council meeting.
Yep.
All these different elements are all game plays, which has come to a head in Osaka around this situation.
Yeah.
And it's all sort of beautifully mastered, I think.
Yeah.
Here. Just kind of enjoy this, because I think it sets up then this seppuku moment, which is so, so tense. You know, again, as I say, a lot of stuff about death here, the meaning of it that Mariko has with, John Blackthorn. But I think, you know, that final kind of plea from Lady Ushiba that she shouldn't look to go through with this, to take her own life. And she says, accepting death isn't surrender. Flowers are only flowers because they fall. It's amazing how the words are so beautiful around something so horrendous.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah, I totally agree. And there's just a little moment there with that conversation with Ushiba and Mariko, and how she ends it, where she just turns around to John and says, we need to go right now. It's almost like, let's not give Ushiba any opportunity here to push anything a different way, to threaten you or something, whatever it may be. And the two of them have that discussion where John tries to ask her to not kill herself, to live on for him. So,
well, that's it. You know, if not for good reason or for your God, consider living for me.
Yes.
Again, it's all these kind of discussions around how should she live or die in this moment, you know?
Absolutely. And again, another big part of Mariko's character comes in here. She is Christian. And one of the fundamental parts of the Christian faith is suicide is a sin and will send you to hell, effectively, is one of the beliefs that's in the Christian faith. So how can she put those two pieces together of her Japanese culture, the honor of seppuku in the times that we're looking at here, versus the idea that in the Christian faith, all of her belief for her whole life is living a way that will get you into heaven. And if she commits seppuku or takes her own life, she goes to hell. So interestingly, the way it's resolved is she reaches out to the other Christian who knows that it's a sin, the other Christian on the council, Lord Kiyama, and asks him to be her second. So he will be the one that will actually strike the killing blow, and she's being killed rather than committing suicide. And as we see the setup with all of the closest people to Mariko in Osaka as set up for her seppuku, Kiyama doesn't even turn up. Again, underlying what we heard earlier, is almost like he's stepping up into his villain role in this episode. What we heard earlier was he doesn't really care about the church. He doesn't really care about Christianity. He cares about the money. So he's not going to be the second for Mariko, even though he nodded yes, even though he nodded that he would be there.
Yeah.
So Blackthorn has to step in. So it's almost like if he hadn't turned up and she had to stab herself without a second, it would have been her killing herself.
Absolutely, absolutely.
My understanding of the ritual itself is the reason why they take your head is because you've made the commitment to take your own life, and having a second means you don't die in pain rather than it being a part of the actual ritual of seppuku. It's you have a second so that you die without going through a lot of pain. So he has almost forced her to take her own life. knowing that it would send her to hell as a Christian. So pretty brutal. But John steps in to be her second in this scene. And I have to say, watching it, I was going, what a way for a love story to end. Yeah. The first time watching it, thinking that this is how Mariko would die. And at the hands of John Blackthorne, who has effectively declared his love for her just the day beforehand, you know?
Yeah, well, that's it. I mean, this whole scene was incredibly tense, incredibly emotional, all the way through. This preparation of Mariko in front of, you know, Lady Shizu and Kiri, her son, and other members of the court. John there as well. Almost the humiliation of Lord Kiyama not showing up as well.
Yeah.
All really tense, very emotional, and taken to the last moment. I mean, so well acted this whole scene from everyone. You know, and I did think it was going to happen until Ishido breaks it with the permit that he gives to her. But I, again,
what an a-hole, though.
No, but even Ishido, it felt so contemptuous.
Mm-hmm,
like, exactly. He knows there's a plan here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we have that previously from Yabushige saying, I know, Ishido knows this is Toranaga. And, you know, he says, a woman flouting the heirs welcome. Disgusting. Yes. So he has no sympathy for her. But he throws her the permit. He doesn't want, again, probably the political calculations of, well, if he doesn't, then all the high families in Osaka will rise up against him because of what he's allowed to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And in that calculation, it's easier to let her leave and then maybe have all the others leave at the same time.
But except that we know he's already taken on Yabushige and taken his offer of...
Well, that's the other thing,
Of aligning with him and being of service to Ishido. So the minute he did that, I was going, oh, has another plan behind this here. So so he deals with the bureaucracy, deals with the permits to leave the city of Osaka, which he just put in the day beforehand. So so now he's drawn up the paperwork to do that. So I guess washing his hands clean of whatever happens now to Lady Mariko.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So just the whole thing was so well done.
Mm-hmm.
And how'd you cut that tension? But with a kiss.
Exactly. Exactly. Mariko and John Blackthorne actually sleep together. So unlike earlier on in the season where I thought for some reason, did they actually sleep together or not? Because of the ruse that they came up with the following day. Yeah, they obviously slept together earlier on in the season, but they also slept together here. John staying in her room for the night as everybody celebrates the fact that Mariko has been able to effectively break this hold that Ishido's had on Osaka.
Because all of a sudden everyone's saying, well, can I get a permit? But shall we move on to
our final Bushido
number five, explosive Bushido number five, the shinobi attack.
Absolutely.
The attack of the assassins, the devil's deal that Yabushige has given to Ishido, or accepted or become a part of with Ishido, where, you know, he will offer his service and Ishido wants one thing in return, and that is ultimately to let the shinobi assassins in to Toranaga's quarters at Osaka Castle. So, you know, ultimately, again, we have the palace here, Toranaga's palace within Osaka, under attack after Yabushige lets in them through the side gate, ultimately.
Yeah.
And they work their way through the palace. I loved Yabushige sort of opening the door and immediately having a knife to his throat just in case it wasn't him. They were kind of getting prepared. And then I loved just seeing the assassin counting with his on his shoulder. And then letting in the second wave of assassins into the palace.
It took me a while, a couple of views to work out what I thought in my head that tapping on the shoulder of Yabushige was. And I think it's for them to hold Yabushige back long enough so the first wave of shinobi can take out their first intended targets, and then he can place himself in the room amongst the other of Taranaga's men said that they can't blame him. They can't suspect him of being the one responsible. I think that's it anyway.
No, I think so. Yeah. And to then let the second wave in.
Yes.
So it looks like they're going after the palace guards, at least in the barracks where they're resting.
Exactly. Or the rest of Taranaga's guards. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
But Yabushige isn't beyond reproach here. The first thing he does is kills one of the guards that comes out to watch over the castle, the people that are on
Seems
night
like
watch
the main
effectively.
Night watchman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So he makes him drink and then kills him. So it's not like his hands are clean of blood here. So,
absolutely not. No, I mean, this is all part of the plan, but then he's being sort of hidden within the chaos. I mean, he's actually trying to bring them out into the main courtyard.
Mm-hmm.
And in the end, they say no. They look to go to a storehouse because it's got a heavy door attached to it. So it looks like Yabushige, in a sense, has failed in his part of the plan, which would be get them out through the courtyard, maybe the front gates, where then it's all open and they can be cut down. Instead, it's they look to go and barricade themselves in the storehouse because that has the heaviest door inside the palace gates.
Yeah.
So they kind of work their way through having to deal with assassins as they're attacking them.
Mm-hmm.
John Blackthorne using his pistol. So I like that. And I also like the use of them with the club end as well.
Yes, absolutely. Just his move of shooting a hole through one of the walls, grabbing the guy and then shooting him in the head through the top of the wall while he's holding him is a fascinating move. They're also muskets, so he has to reload them after every shot or every two shots, which is really interesting. And I would presume, again, I haven't read the book, I'm sorry, I still haven't gotten up there, but in the book I do understand that what John Blackthorne brought to the Japanese is the use of muskets in the book, and then that's corrected for the show because the Japanese had guns available to them for 50 years before this all took place. So in the TV show, it's the cannons that John is the way to use the cannons is what John's brought to them. So so I suppose it would be a big payoff, I would guess, in the book, if you know that John has brought the guns to Japan, and here in the end he's battling everybody with guns while they're all using swords. So I could understand why it would be slightly different in the book, I suppose. It's kind of like a culmination of what you know about Blackthorne. But here he is absolutely defending and fighting everybody off around Mariko. You know, we talked about it a couple of times throughout the series here that John Blackthorne isn't the central character of the show. It is a three-hander here with Mariko Toranaga and John Blackthorne plus all the other wider cast, but he is playing a pivotal role in this scene. If he wasn't there, Mariko absolutely could have been cut down earlier than that. He is
absolutely
a proper defender to her here, gets her into the storehouse with the heavy doors, is shouting for Yabushige to help him block the doors so that the shinobi can't come in and kill them all. And Yabushige sits back, looking with a scared look on his face, not helping John Blackthorne as he shouts for that help before Mariko makes her final move.
Well, and you hear that they're going to blow the doors open with a can. So, and this is where then Mariko gives her life by pushing herself up against the door as then the cannon is fired into the door.
Mm.
Fade to black.
Yes. Yes.
They're like really, really shocking. I mean, I don't expect that she has survived that at all.
No.
And I mean, it's coming off the back of the near point of seppuku from her. And you kind of thought, okay, she's safe.
Yeah.
And then, you know, to slow down the shinobi to sort of, you know, do her duty to her lord. But also, I'm guessing, with her own thoughts of what she's been wanting to do, like we saw at the start of the episode, it kind of reflects that, really. In this moment, she finds an opportunity to end her life honorably and dutifully by using herself as a barricade for the door before it's blown in.
Yeah.
You know, so as I say, it's just that mirroring of what happens at the start. You know, she sees this opportunity to end her own life.
Yes, but also and very clearly her final words are calling out what Ishido has done here. She's calling out who she is and that it is Ishido behind this shinobi attack to the people that are around her, including John and the other handmaidens and Toranaga's wife. So she's being really clear that it's not her taking her own life. She is sacrificing herself to save those inside, and it is Ishido who's behind it all.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh, what a episode, and what
absolutely
an amazing
crimson
way to
fly in.
Yeah.
Yeah, like really, really emotional.
Yeah. And I wonder, you know, as we had mentioned at the beginning of the episode about, you know, people's expectation from the show, hearing the term Crimson Sky, which had been described earlier on in the season as an all-out assault on Osaka, everybody joining up together, Toranaga and his entire armed forces having a one-out assault on Osaka Castle. And here, that all-out assault is played out through Mariko and her words to Bushido in the castle. That is the Crimson Sky that they have enacted effectively. So I wonder what the expectation, again, when people were coming in, knowing that's the name of the episode, expecting an all-out battle, expecting, you know, all the riders to come in and save Mariko before she dies in this all-out war between Toranaga and the residents, I guess, inside Osaka Castle. And that doesn't happen. This is a really personal, private story of the journey that Mariko has taken throughout the series, really, and how it all ends.
Yeah. No, absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah. Anything else you want to talk about from the episode, John?
No, nothing from me. How about yourself, Derek? Any notes from this episode?
Just the only thing that we just tend not to mention very often is the priests. You know, we talked about Father Martin, but there is a conversation between all of them as John is arriving into the city, as the Anjin is arriving in the city, where they still suspect that he is central to the plan, and they even call out war is coming, effectively. Yeah. So they think the arrival of the Anjin is the signifier that war is coming, when actually it's nothing to do with that. They mentioned to Father Martin that they do see Mariko coming in as well. Your friend is coming in, you know. But I just wanted to, I suppose, call them out that they are still watching and watchful of the Anjin, who could bring down their whole connection between Japan and Portugal. So just thought it was quite interesting. But also John's line when he's looking out at the deliveries coming in on the black ship. He sees the black ship in port and calls out that here they are coming in with their cheap silks to get your Japanese silver for a very cheap price.
Yeah.
So calling out once again that he's watching what the Portuguese are doing, and everybody seems to be letting them away with it. So so just an interesting one. This episode was absolutely about Mariko, absolutely about that, those political machinations that are going on, how they play off against each other. But just those little moments in the background with the Portuguese were interesting. Great stuff, John. Overall, what's your final thoughts on Shogun Chapter 9, Crimson Sky?
I absolutely love this episode. I'd give it 5. You've only gone and blown the bloody doors off out of 5. No, you shouldn't. But I just thought this was hugely emotional and tense, and emotionally tense. I think everyone here just really conveyed that. As I say, it was as taut as a violin string all the way through this, and yet no, as such, big all-out battle. You know, very much about political maneuvering your opponent into a corner to possibly bring about, you know, the war.
Yeah.
And so many great scenes between Mariko here and Ishido at court with Lady Ochiba, where they kind of reconnect against Ishido's troops as she tries to leave, and then with the attempted seppuku until Ishido comes in with the permit. And I just thought it was absolutely fantastic. And I mean, each one of the actors here, in particular Anna Sawai, you know, as Mariko, just so good. So, yeah.
Just that heartbreaking moment where she's overwhelmed by Ishido's men and falls to the ground going, I can't fight back against these men. It's just really touching. It's a tough episode to watch, and she is so good in the episode, absolutely. But so many other actors are within the show. They're really, really strong cast.
Definitely.
Excellent stuff. John, we have a bit of feedback in from our fellow warriors on Chapter 8 of the show.
Excellent stuff.
First off, over on YouTube, just a quick one in response to last week's review, the one that we got, a lovely 5-star review. Lissa said, "You are the best Shogun podcast."
Oh, thank you,
very
Lissa.
Very sweet of Lissa to say that. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. It's always nice to get compliments, and we don't take compliments well, so it is nice to get them.
That's lovely. Thank you so much, Lissa. Over on email, we got some feedback from Julian, who goes, "Hi guys, Julian from Texas here. I just want to start off and say I enjoy your Shogun conversations very much. Thanks for bringing the quality content. With that said, I'm writing in to push back some of your takes from episode 8 and some feedback from an email you read from episode 7.
Mm.
You guys said you believe there was definitely an off-screen conversation between Hiramatsu and Toranaga regarding Hiramatsu committing seppuku. I wholeheartedly believe it is the total opposite. I think Hiramatsu knew full well that for the council to actually believe Toranaga's intention to surrender, it would take something of such seriousness that it wouldn't leave any space for doubt. They both knew something needed to be done, and when Toranaga's other generals started threatening seppuku, Hiramatsu read the room and had to act because their army couldn't stand to lose multiple generals at once."
Mm.
You could read it on Toranaga's face that he absolutely was devastated by what was happening in front of him, but you could sort of see they were communicating without words.
Mm.
I don't believe that Toranaga would ever ask him to commit seppuku, even though he knew he would do it. If they had spoken about it prior to this point, then I don't think Toranaga's quivering face and his held back tears would have been as prominent as they were, since he would have been emotionally prepared and probably would have put on a straight face, because that's who he is outside of this eightfold fence. I think the whole situation hits harder this way."
Mm.
Excellent stuff, Julian. And, you know, I actually would agree with you.
I can see that, yeah.
I think maybe the conversation, possibly not so much about seppuku, mm-hmm. but about the ultimate goal and aim. You know, this Hiramatsu was the closest advisor. So I would totally get your point here. And actually, that communication without words, probably most important. So I totally think you've actually nailed it here.
Yeah.
It probably is that. As I say, I was just thinking it was so shocking, and that it must have been part of the plan. But I guess with your feedback, it's part of the plan in the sense that they know the ultimate goal of what's being attempted.
Yeah. I think part of it was because of Toranaga's conversation with Mariko at the end, yeah. where he says that Hiramatsu knew his place. He knew what he had to do.
Yeah.
But I think, to your point, Julian, it's a great point. I think Hiramatsu knew his duty regardless of whether he had a conversation with Toranaga or not. Even if there was no conversation between the two, Hiramatsu knew this is what he had to do in this moment to ensure the success of Toranaga's plan. He was that dedicated to him. He knew Toranaga for all of his life, right from his first battle, from back when he was 13 years old.
Yeah.
So he not only is the trusted person at his side, he knows exactly what to do in every moment to ensure the success of his Lord Toranaga. So that's a really good suggestion. They may not have had a conversation, but all of their life lived together means Hiramatsu knows exactly what he should be doing,
yeah.
even if he's not being asked to do it specifically.
Absolutely.
So, great point.
Yeah. Julian continues, "And about last week's feedback, a listener wrote in saying that Buntaro is simply just a classic abuser and he does not love Mariko, and you seem to agree with this take. While I'm not saying Buntaro isn't an abuser, because he most definitely is, but the showrunner said Buntaro undeniably very much loves Mariko. I don't want to say more on that because I don't want to be misconstrued as being apologetic towards abuse, but according to Justin Marks, there is more to it than that. If you go back and listen to the first 5 minutes of the official Shogun podcast for Episode 5, Broken to the Fist, you can hear them speak on the matter. Keep up the great work, guys, and I'll be listening next week, Julian." Thanks so much, Julian. I think my only point around Buntaro is I have a feeling, given the size of the book, there's a lot of stuff that is concentrated around Buntaro
maybe,
to some extent.
Yeah, maybe condensed, yeah.
Or condensed, or just they can only go with certain threads,
maybe
just the writing around certain events as well, just yeah. how it's done. It's difficult to know. I think we also have to remember it's 16th century Japan, not only a different culture, but different time
mm-hmm.
and different perspectives.
Yeah.
However, good or bad they are,
yeah.
I think it is a difficult topic to have. And I think it might be more, I think what I was trying to say last week is that Buntaro probably believes he loves her.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the two things aren't mutually exclusive, that Buntaro thinks he loves her. But our point last week, what we were talking about was, he doesn't know what love is. He's treating his wife like this. He is an abuser. Interestingly, actually, Gillian, the original piece of feedback we got in was actually quoting Justin Marks on the official Shogun podcast back in episode 5. We've actually talked about this quite a few times over the course of our discussions on Shogun. There's been lots of these talks about whether Buntaro loves his wife or not. He doesn't show that he loves her, treats her really badly, and the scene that we saw in last week's episode where the tea that he tries to make for the ceremony that he tries to do for, and Mariko tells him she has never loved him,
yeah,
is probably the important story that they're pulling out of Shogun. Whether Buntaro does think that they were ever in love or that he loved her doesn't really matter, because Mariko has had to put up with him for as long as she has over the years, yeah, and she's the one that pushed back at him.
And it's ultimately, it's not mutual.
Yeah, I certainly wouldn't want to criticize what Justin Marks was saying. This is his show. He's one of the showrunners on the show. He has his opinion about what James Clavell was trying to get across, and has an opinion of what he was trying to get across in the show. But there are a number of other writers in the show. The way I certainly take it here is that Mariko and Buntaro were not supposed to be together, whether she likes him or not, or loves him or not, or whether he loves her or not. Yeah. To me, that doesn't really matter. He's come across as an abuser. He's hit her multiple times. He's treated her absolutely abhorrently throughout the series. That's what I've seen. So whether that was the intention of Justin Marks or not, it just didn't come across in the show.
I think, like we said last week, Buntaro is just that difficult, difficult character.
Mm-hmm.
If you just look at it at high level history, it's that, you know, he was faithful servant to his lord.
Yeah.
Da, da, da. At a personal level, completely different. Even last week's, you know, he lost his father, his mm-hmm. wife, effectively,
yeah,
and really has been sidelined by Toranaga to
yeah.
some degree in the episode.
Yeah.
And you're kind of like going, maybe that makes the realization at a personal level, mm-hmm. level, no matter how much of a good warrior and fighter he
yeah.
is, or a good shot with a bow and arrow.
Absolutely. And the great thing of this show is that no character is just anything. Everybody's something really complex and
yeah.
works in gray areas and black and white areas. So, Buntaro is a person that fights alongside his lord and is massively competent at that role. So there's lots of interesting yeah. things about every character in the show. Nobody's just anything.
It's really interesting because, I mean, even in this episode, you have John Blackthorne sort of castigating Toranaga for using a woman to sort of fulfill his plan, or putting mm-hmm. a woman in danger like Mariko. So it I guess it's just really, like, every, you know, the complexity around yeah. these lives are really just that, are complex, but
exactly.
great stuff. Thanks, Julian, for the feedback. Really
Absolutely.
Good to get your thoughts.
Yeah, thanks, Julian.
I would say you're probably bang on with your theory around Hiramatsu.
Yeah, absolutely. Just didn't cross my mind. Yeah.
No, it didn't actually. I was kind of led a bit by that conversation mm-hmm. with Mariko a bit.
Yeah, yeah.
But good stuff. Thanks, Julian.
Thanks, Julian. Also, over email, Franca sent an email into us. She says, "Hi, Derek and John. I am enjoying your Shogun podcast, listening religiously each week after I watch each episode. I read the book back in the 80s and was totally enthralled by it at the time, since it was my first fictional historical novel. When the miniseries came out with Richard Chamberlain, I was a dedicated viewer back when we couldn't record TV shows, so you had to make sure you were in front of the TV each night for those 5 episodes. I do want to pay tribute to Richard Chamberlain, who played the John Blackthorne character. He passed away in March this year at the age of 90. He drew many fans to watch the series, since at the time he was a bit of a heartthrob. I'm glad I do not remember the storyline, since I read the book over 40 years ago. So when I watch the current series, I'm at the edge of my seat to see how Toranaga will survive the political schemes, if Blackthorne is able to leave the Japans, and how Mariko will resolve her family shame and attraction to Blackthorne. After the series is finished, I plan to read the book again, as I'm curious how closely they followed the storyline, but also to immerse myself back into the world James Clavell built. Thanks for sharing the love, Franca."
Excellent stuff. Thank you, Franca, for listening.
Yeah, it's great to hear from you again, Franca. I haven't heard from you in a while on our feedback. Yeah. I know we put out podcasts very quickly, so sometimes it's difficult to get your feedback into us in time for episodes. But it's great to hear from you.
And you're right, actually. Richard Chamberlain was a bit of a heartthrob back in the day. I remember my mum having sort of feelings for him. You know, I think, in fact, I don't really remember watching the 80s miniseries of this, but I remember it being on. I just don't think I followed it in a sense.
He was the 1-2 punch for Richard Chamberlain of The Thornbirds and Shogun. Those are the two big shows that he had in the 80s, which every mother I knew was watching, so we all heard about them. So yes, he was a massive heartthrob in the 80s. So thanks very much for that, Frank. A well-timed tribute to,
absolutely,
to his portrayal. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And like you say, I really do want to sort of get into the world of the book as well, just to see, you know, books just, again, different medium brings different things and see how it holds up or how it connects in with the show.
Absolutely interesting. We got some feedback over on Facebook from Jamie Lawton next, who says, totally awesome. The story has diverged from the novel a bit, but still spellbinding and spectacular. Actually moves the story along a bit faster, and unexpected twists from, as I said before, a saga well known, to make it a real edge of the seat viewing and exciting. I love that it explores the other minor characters' backstories a bit more than the original and shifts attention away from Blackthorn and focuses on a bit more of the rest of the stellar cast. So that's interesting. That's the connection to the book and how the show has been changing the story so that it's not just focused on Blackthorn's story, which I know the book did focus on other characters as well. You did get to learn more about the other characters. But yeah, there does seem to be some changes from the book to broaden out the story and broaden out the tale here.
But that's it. I mean, it is these three main characters, as you say, but to me, it's also just so much broader than that because they're placed within all these supporting characters, whether it's Yabushige, Ishido, Achiba, Omi and Toranaga's son, Nagakata, you know, all of them are just so well done. Hiramatsu. Yeah. And I find it's just that, yes, Blackthorn, Mariko, Toranaga are these main, you know, are the main starring cast. And how it comes up in the credits, but it does feel like an ensemble.
Yes.
It really does. Yeah. And I really, really enjoy it for that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Good stuff. Thanks, Jamie.
Yeah. Thanks, Jamie.
Dr. Bob Phillips says, breathless. This had as many powerful scenes as most shows have an entire season. Mm-hmm. Every drop of heart's blood wrung from us in the ultimate ploy, the perfect tea party, the palliation and passing of the old queen mother, the wake and the recanting of European supremacy was done with such beauty and precision. This is a masterpiece.
Oh, what a brilliant word for the show so far. And that was episode 8. I can't wait to hear your thoughts on episode 9, Dr. Bob. The show has just had so many amazing moments in each episode, let alone in the series overall, or seasons. You know, we early on talked about things like Game of Thrones, which would have a denouement at the end of the season after 8 episodes that had this massive moment at the end of the season. And that does feel like we're getting, at least dramatically, we're getting those kind of big moments in each episode.
It is, but it's intimate, big, dramatic moments.
Yes.
And I think that's really comes about in this episode. And I think, like with the wake of Nagakata last week, you know, it's those little moments. It's the expressions on the face. And it's just done so well here.
Really is.
In terms of the actors, the writing, the director, what they're picking up on. And again, similarly here, in the episode this week, I just find the intimacy of it really, really dramatic. And I've not had that in a long time because a lot of the time you go, you want the big action piece.
Mm-hmm.
I'm happy not to have that here because everything, it's an action piece with words, like because you're digging for that meaning behind it, the threat, the warning, whatever it might be, you know, just so good. Yeah. Thanks so much, Dr. Bob.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dr. Bob.
And we have a final bit of feedback on the wire from Hatamoto Von Doom, who says, yo, warriors, not much of a reunion for John Blackthorn and crew. I see Mariko made her feelings clearly known to Buntaro. Dude should have done better from the start. I laughed out loud when the Portuguese monk saw his church was to be next door to a brothel. The ordeal of Hiramatsu's seppuku to Toranaga was quite tragic. It also further screwed up Buntaro. I'm very curious about Mariko's mission in Osaka. Will it shake John Blackthorne from his deal with the Yabushiki? Toranaga better pull a rabbit out of his hat after all of this. Perhaps a secret involving his half-brother? Don't lose your head. Sayonara, Hatamoto von Doom. Thank you so much, Hatamoto von Doom, for the feedback. Certainly, I think Buntaro really got the pointy end of everyone here.
Mm-hmm.
And I think you're right, you know, that rabbit out of the hat from Toranaga. Be interesting to see what it is and how that links to Mariko, or indeed his half-brother, because it's a great theory that we've gotten through as well about the half-brother possibly being sort of the Trojan horse, really.
But potentially, yeah, that's a really interesting idea, isn't it? And I wonder if this Crimson Sky plan that Mariko has now carried out effectively in Osaka is the plan for Toranaga to now be able to just walk into Osaka, and the stranglehold that Ishido's had on it is now gone. So,
yeah, I mean, you know. Yeah, absolutely. I do feel there's still got to be warfare. Whether it's fully shown in one episode, probably that's not going to happen, you know, that campaign. But at least I think there has to be some kind of warfare or meeting on the battleground. But whether, you know, it's quite as lopsided as we think it is. Because at the moment, it's Toranaga really has a depleted force, so we'll have to see.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Great stuff. Thanks, Victor.
Yeah, thanks, Victor.
And thanks, everybody, for your feedback. Keep sending it in to us to feedback@tvpodcastindustries.com. Or if you want to join us in our Facebook group, you can join us at facebook.com/groups/TVPodcastIndustries, where there's a spoiler post up there for each of the episodes as we discuss them. But there's only one more to go, John.
I know.
You know, it's interesting. I suppose the central purpose of this episode was Mariko trying to break the control that Ishido had on Osaka. And while, of course, the end is really tragic and what happened to Mariko before that, he had signed the forms allowing her to leave the city, had given up effectively on this holding of the prisoners. So what's left to happen in the final episode next week? You know, the other prisoners were also asking for their leave, and he told them, submit the forms and you can go as well. So has he lost control completely now in Osaka? Can Toranaga walk back in to the city and take it over? It'll be interesting to see how they play it out.
Yeah, absolutely. I feel it's the foundations of Ishido are possibly have been worn away from this. Whether it's the other regents, whether it's Lady Ishiba, I don't know.
Yeah.
But I think it's that his power base built up of the allies, not just the walls of Osaka Castle, it's the allies have possibly a different view of him now.
Absolutely.
You know?
Absolutely. I guess we'll see next Tuesday when the next episode and final episode of Shogun Chapter 10, A Dream of a Dream, comes out. We'll be back talking about that on our main feed on TV Podcast Industries and, of course, on the Shogun on TV Podcast Industries podcast. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll talk to you again next time.
Yeah, absolutely great chatting all things around Shogun with you, fellow warriors. Until next week, though, keep watching and, of course, keep listening.
Bye.
Bye.